anything, me or the union can do to help you.
Okay, good morning. I'll call to order the meeting of the Legislative Commission on Pensions Retirement for Friday, February 12, 2010. We do have a quorum present. The first item on the agenda is approval of the minutes of the February 5, 2010 meeting. Is there a motion to approve the minutes? Anybody? Senator Lynch moves approval of the minutes. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Let's see. Senator Tomasoni and Representative Mahoney are not here. I'll take their bill up when they're here, so that since they're not on the commission. But since they are not, we'll start with the issue that was on last week's agenda, and then we delayed it until this week. This was a document, LCPR 10-005 from MSRS, a retirement-related administrative provisions. Okay. Oh, Representative Mahoney, do you know if Senator Tomasoni is in the area right now?
I don't know.
Oh, if you were here, both of you were here, I'd be ready to take up your issue first, but otherwise we'll take something else up before you get here.
Well, suppose I could. I can do that.
Why don't you see if he's available? So, we'll just hold off for just a second here and see if he's in his. Why don't you stay here? So,
I will.
Okay. Okay. Did you lose your boss?
I'm
here. No, he's not. You lost him.
The definition of behind is further behind than the
bedroom. Okay. Well, if he's on his way, maybe Representative Mahoney, why don't you get to the witness table and maybe we can just start talking about your issue then, as long as you're here. So let's take up number four, Senate File 1407, Senator Tomasoni, and House File 1358, Representative Mahoney. And Representative Mahoney, welcome to the Pensions Commission.
Thank you, members. Glad to be here. And my cohort is here. Members, today we're trying to present a fix to a problem that treats people differently, trying to set this up so that state employees are treated the same whether they work at the Department of Health, the Department of Education, or in the legislature, or our current legislators. Even '97, the system changed and required everyone to be in a defined contribution. This allows them to make a choice whether they want to be in the defined contribution or the defined benefit. That is the first half of it. I think this is an amendment that Senator Tomasoni has. I'll let him take over from there on 17A.
Yes, Senator Tomasoni, welcome to the commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and commission members. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Mr. Chairman, I first found this out at that legislators are actually treated differently than other state employees and when it comes to pension decisions. And I always heard my constituents tell me that legislators should be treated the same as everybody else. And what this refers to is the fact that after a state employee has worked for the state for 10 years, when they retire, they are allowed to decide whether or not they want to take the unclassified pension or the general, the MSRS general coverage pension. And I found out that legislators don't have that ability to do the same thing as the other people who are state employees. And so it seemed to me a fairness issue, and that and that people who started after 97 should be, if they've been in the legislature for 10 years, should be allowed to have the same privileges as the other state employees have. And I then decided to see how many legislators have been in the legislature for 10 years or more. And so I looked at the 2000 book, and the Senate has 44 different members right now than we had in 2000. And the House has over 100 members that are different than they had in 2000. So people don't hang around here for that long. So I'm thinking that it probably doesn't apply to that many people. And then all of a sudden you have the economy that goes in the tank, and all the funds go down pretty badly too. And so somebody could possibly look at this bill and say this is legislators trying to do something for themselves, but quite frankly, it's nothing more than trying to be treated the same as everybody else. And so, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure exactly what the best way to proceed here is, but maybe you should give me some advice.
Well, let me give you a little. We've actually worked on some aspects of this over the interim. We've had regular monthly meetings of the Pension Commission, and I can kind of bring you up to speed to some of the discussions. And actually, we've sort of changed the direction for future hires. I'll have staff in a minute just explain what's already been adopted. But just some of the background here. I came on the Pension Commission in 1997, so I was there when the changes were made. And I think there was an uneasiness from the legislators, the idea that some of them would be able to accumulate years of legislative service and then roll them into a rather high-paying, say, commissioner position and get a very good high five out of that. I've used an example a couple of times, maybe fair or not, but Senator Neville spent about 18 years in the legislature, and he became a judge, and, you know, he's a very good judge, and, you know, that's what he wanted to do. He didn't become a judge to get a better pension, and he didn't have any idea, I'm told, that what the pension implications were, because he didn't set up the rules. But what happened was he's able to use the years in the legislature towards a judicial pension. Now, again, that wasn't his goal, but that's just how it plays out. And I think that there is some uneasiness, and there's many other examples, too, from all political parties, both political parties. But I think there was some easiness back then of letting those things happen. The issue that we've had was the unclassified service tends to have people who usually work for a short period of time. And you can see that around the legislature here. There's a lot of hires that come in here. They're never going to retire out of this place. They're going to serve maybe a year or two or a couple of years and then move on. So they're never going to qualify for the normal pension. And so that's typical in other areas of state government for the unclassified pensions. And so what the unclassified plan was designed for those people who are going to expect to serve a short period of time, be able to get something down the road, if not the 30-year pension. We do have some employees in the legislature and elsewhere in government who do come into these positions and do stay long, you know, and that's why I think the thought was after 10 years they could opt to switch over from the defined contribution plan to the defined benefit plan. The problem that was identified to us over the interim was the fact that a number of these employees will wait until they're ready to retire, and then they decide which one they want to go in. And I think we had some discomfort with allowing that to continue. At some point, you just ought to decide one or the other and not both. And, in fact, I'll have staff because we had just adopted that last week as part of the MSRS, but we talked about it a few months ago, but maybe staff could refresh us as to what we have adopted as our proposal for the new employees. Mr. Martin?
Okay, members. Currently, in the unclassified plan, individuals who are covered by that other than legislators have within the first year to choose whether they want to, they're eligible, they could be in the unclassified plan. They have a year to decide whether they're not going to be in the unclassified plan or in the regular MSRS general plan. If they elect either by default, they make no election and they're in the unclassified plan, or they affirmatively elect to be in the unclassified plan, and they're in state service for at least 10 years, at or before termination, they can choose to transfer to the MSRS general plan, get a defined benefit plan benefit, and all of their contributions and all of their employer contributions and any investment earnings will be transferred to the MSRS general plan. That's current law. What you have done last week, if you look on tab Omni in your packets, it's the last item in your packets. This is the omnibus retirement bill as it sits as of last week. And you turn to page 11 of that document. This might help. Section 9 of Article 2 is the relevant provision. And the basic change you're doing there, and it's in the new language on lines 17 through 20, is you're retaining for existing staff the if you get 10 or more years, you can elect to transfer to the MSRS unclassified plan. But for anybody who comes on board after June 30, 2010, the change is different. You have to do it within the first 7 years of employment, and if you don't do it before the end of your seventh year of state service, then you are stuck in the unclassified plan and cannot subsequently change.
Now, and we tried to talk. We did talk again a couple of months ago, but you know, should we try to consider that for, say, legislators and so forth? There are some issues that come on up that we talked about. The fact that when you're in the unclassified defined contribution plan, the employer is making a 6% contribution, and the contributions change whether you're in the defined benefit or the defined contribution plan. And so, you know, making that switch over for one plan or the other does cause some complications. I suppose it can be done. But we had generally talked about saying, well, if for legislators, should we, if we want to treat everybody the same, should we say, okay, you've got a certain time period to make your election, and then whatever you elect, that's it, as opposed to waiting until the day you retire or until you – because that just goes contrary to all pension principles, because we have – every year we get people coming in who make one choice early on and they want to come back and make a different choice, and unfortunately that you can't allow pensions to go that way. So both – Senator Tomasoni, Representative Mahoney, we did want to change the underlying policy that you're referring to. We just didn't circle around and figure out, okay, legislators should or should not be affected by some of these changes. And, you know, obviously a lot of this is probably new to you, but, you know, we've been thinking about it. So do you have an initial reaction as to how that's going to be? Because we're changing the rules, you know, for the unclassified. And so it's not a matter of treating us the same, because they're going to be treated differently too. So they don't wait until the end and then choose one or the other. Any thoughts?
Well, Mr. Chairman, my initial thought about the judge, I don't see how it fits into what I'm trying to do, because I think that's a little bit different issue than just whether or not you want to choose the general plan or the unclassified plan upon retirement. So I'm not sure how Senator Neville fits in, but I think we're probably past that though. I think we're at least getting to a point where we can. If you have to make a decision within a certain period of time and then decide which plan you're going to be with and then it's irrevocable, I think that's probably a good recommendation and a good compromise. I don't know what Representative Mahoney thinks of.
Representative Mahoney, do you have any thoughts?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, yes, I think it's a good start. I think the problem here is a bit broader than what this narrowly defined compromise gets to, but again, a start is always better than no movement at all. I want to go back and address where you started with the concern with judges and people coming out of these offices and employment in the legislative branch and going to the next level of going to another place in employment. I haven't gotten quite all the information, but of the 450 people who have left over the last 10 years, there's 20 that have, I think it's 20%. So, no, it's 54% have gone on to a job where they have been available to get a higher high five boost. The question I had to ask of
that came from the Senate.
Well, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, you started to say and then switched several different times, so I'm not sure I'm tracking with you. How many people? I thought you said a number and then a percentage.
Correct.
And I wasn't.
Yeah, and I should be clearer here. I've asked MSRS to come up with the numbers that of people that would be affected by this. I wasn't trying to be rude by looking at my cell phone. I was trying to find the email because I don't have it with me. And I will get that to the committee members. There is a number of people that this affects. The second question that they did not ask, and I'm in the process of asking this with them, is this where someone changes their complete high five, or do they go into a different branch of government service, increase their salary for a year, and then change their high five minimally? I think that needs to be looked at in the part of this. But again, to the original question, I don't think this gets to the full answer, but I think it is a start forward. And if we need to, if you as the committee need to change the contribution levels because they do change, I think that's a fair part to that kind of a compromise. So although I would prefer the original language, as I said, some kind of a compromise or a start is always better than nothing.
Mr. Chairman, if I'm understanding what you're suggesting that as opposed to just making legislators on a par with other state employees who have worked for 10 years that can then choose one or the other when they retire, that you make a date certain during their service to make such a choice. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, Senator Thompson, I think we felt that there were problems with the current system for unclassified employees. I mean, there's a reason why we have the unclassified plan. And there are people, as I say, you know, who will go into government service and spend much longer than was ever intended for unclassified positions. But, you know, if they choose to do that, they were given the option of choosing one or the other after 10 years. But the big problem that came to our attention, first of all, was the fact that they could wait until they retired to make the choice. I think we wanted to stop that practice, but in order to do that, we try to figure out how does it affect current employees, how it's going to affect future employees, and at least the discussion from the Pension Commission ultimately came down to saying, well, you know, it's going to be more problematic to try to solve it for the current employees, but for future employees, we just don't think that you should be able to go on that current system. You come in on a classified, as Mr. Martin described. We'll give you about 7 years to decide which plan you want to be in, but then you make a choice and you stick with that. So that's going to be, if this bill passes, that would be the rule for the new employees. Now, if you're saying we need to treat everybody the same, then that would be the rule that if somebody comes in, as an example, a legislator comes in, starts in the unclassified plan, as everybody since Representative Tremba, you know, has been. But if they want to make a switch, they'd have a certain time period to do that, and then that's it. You know, you can't just keep going on and on and on and trying to figure out which one's going to be a better pension plan in the long run. I don't know what we would do for all those people elected since 1997, you know, who may want to now go back and revisit it. We may, if that's the direction this commission goes in, we may have to give them a window to make a switch if that's what we choose to do. But as I'm saying, you know, it's the current plan has problems that I think we wanted to address. And so we don't want to put legislators into that old system that has some glitches in it. So Representative Kahn.
What about when somebody makes a supposedly irrevocable choice and then claims it was a mistake? I'm trying to think of the Randy Kelly situation, which was pushed on us by the Senate. And
I don't – yeah.
And so that we can have a succession of separate bills to correct these mistakes?
Representative Kahn, there undoubtedly will be bills. The explanation he gave was that he just became mayor of St. Paul. He had a bunch of papers shoved in front of him, didn't know what he was signing and so forth. I think another possible explanation would be that when he got to be mayor of St. Paul, he kind of thought that he'd have the job for a long period of time. It would probably work out better for him if he chose one option. And by having only served one term, it didn't quite work out that way. But
that's what some of us thought.
That's what some of us thought. I understand, yes. And so people undoubtedly will make one choice and come back and say, I screwed up. I shouldn't have. Why did you let me do that? Those things have been known to happen, yes. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Tomassoni, just to give you a little background on where I'm coming from on this issue, I don't have the objection so much to the idea of switching back and forth between the plans. From what I understand of the history, you know, why this was put in place, sometimes we have people switch back and forth between plans when they come here, as long as they're making up the difference and there isn't any actual cost to a plan. But what I have objection with, and this was before I ever knew about your bill last year, having been on this long enough, I realized that we have a situation happening throughout our pension systems that seem to me to be not justified. And that's the situation where someone who is has many, many years in the legislature at a relatively low-paying job can take those years and then with a political appointment into a job that might pay three or four times as much, at least three times as much, really enhance their retirement benefit in a way that they're kind of getting, perhaps could be viewed as a political favor, getting this golden parachute in their retirement, which to me seems very different when you have a political appointment of someone than someone who just works themselves normally up through the system, gradually getting increases and the normal high five type of situation that I think our system envisions. And so when I first learned that people were able to do this and this was happening, it seemed to me that this was something that would be hard to justify. And so I actually wanted a bill, and I've actually had an amendment drawn, if we're going to be visiting this issue with your bill, that would, which I will offer, that would basically eliminate the possibility of doing that in terms of a retirement benefit. But the reason it makes a difference in this ability to switch between plans is because if you're in the unclassified plan, anyone who's 1997, I think, and after, you don't have that opportunity to put those things together and get that high five benefit that would jump your retirement way up. If you're in the general plan, either already or if you were to switch into the general plan, then you would have that option. And so that's my problem with the bill. It's not your particular bill or your particular situation where you may find that you'd rather be in the general plan because it's, your issue or your life circumstances have changed since when, or just for whatever reason you may have. But I have this underlying concern with this other issue, and that's why I have the objection of going down this road and in this direction, not because of anything you've done or would do, but just because we have this general concept out there, which I think is wrong.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, you're right. My bill doesn't deal with that at all. And quite frankly, the only reason that Representative Mahoney and I introduced the bill is because we found out that there were options for state employees that legislators didn't have, and it just seemed to be a fairness issue. It's interesting that at the end of the 10-year period, people can opt for which one's better, but legislators didn't have that option, and state employees do, and that is all we're trying to address here, I think, and your issue is a totally different issue than what I think I'm trying to deal with.
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Yeah, Representative Mahoney.
And that might be a fair assessment, Senator Olson, but I came in 99, and I've never had the opportunity to progress in my salary. Never had that opportunity, and no one that's come in after 97 has had that, 98, 99, has had that opportunity. So, fair assessment, but I think you're comparing apples and oranges.
Yep. Sarah
Mr.
Olson.
Chair, well, and with respect, I guess, I'm not sure if I'm understanding what you're saying, but it seems to me that if what we're saying is no one in the legislature has gotten a pay increase for however many years that is, 13 years, and that's not really fair, then I guess I would probably say I don't disagree with that, but to me that's a separate issue, and it doesn't justify allowing something with pensions that would be hard to justify on its own merits.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Again, as I was stated earlier, I was looking on my email for that information. I don't have that in front of me or with me. I believe that it has affected one or two people on average a year. My question to the pension people has been, and they haven't gotten back to me, is are we looking at someone like Judge Neville who has could actually have 10, 20 years in service, or a person who goes to the chief of staff for 9 months and makes that change? And I think there's a whole lot more 9 month type people than there are the 10 or 15 year people. So yeah. I'm not sure that's an issue.
Well, believe it or not, in a building like this, there are some political implications too.
Yes.
And the political implications happen to be that even if it may affect a small number of people, if you deal with something with legislative pensions and it, you know, and the public perceives it the wrong way, it's going to affect, you know, everybody in this place. And I think we have to be sensitive to that and just make sure that we understand, you know, understand that. So, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It might be helpful to sometimes in conversations like this, it's helpful for us if we can kind of revert back to the pension policies and principles. And if you look at that specifically under Section C, under pension benefit coverage, number 3 is entitled Equal Treatment Within Pension Plans. It's pretty straightforward. There should be equal pension treatment of public employees in terms of the relationship between benefits and contributions. And as as we're talking with our constituents, I think whether it's in issues on healthcare or issues on taxes, issues of how we're going to balance the budget, one thing that I think our constituents collectively understand is this concept of fairness, and that we're all kind of in this together. Mr. Chair, there was an amendment, a 5A amendment that was distributed.
Yeah. There have been discussions going on.
Are you ready to entertain discussion on that amendment, or could staff walk through that?
Mr. Martin, could you explain the amendment?
Members, the Dash 5A amendment that's before you amends two different sections of law. The 3A change is to the legislator's plan. The bottom half of the 5A amendment, lines 20 through 28, would amend 352D, the unclassified plan. What it does is for legislators who are in office before 2010, those legislators would have until January 1 of 2011 to elect whether they're going to be in the general plan or the unclassified plan. This is the date certain, the broad date certain approach that Senator Betz described. And the bottom of the bill, lines 21 through 28, with respect to the unclassified plan and post-2010 legislators, they would have no more than 7 years to determine whether or not they want to be in the unclassified plan or to make a switch to the general employee plan.
This is the number of people that are going to pay.
So for current legislators, a date certain before 2011, and for newly elected legislators, a 7-year grace period during which they can choose.
So just as an example, we just had a new senator sworn in this past week, so he would have until next January to make a option, but then everybody else after that, after him, would have 7 years, just so I understand what the timeline. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. As I say, this is kind of a proposal that seems a little consistent with what we're doing with the new state hires that try to address some of the issues. I don't know what the commission thinks about this, but this is one way to approach it. Any discussion or thoughts? What do you want to do on the bill, on the amendment? Any further ideas, members? What do you want to do, if anything? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be interested in hearing from Senator Thomasoni and Representative Mahoney. The 5A is perhaps not exactly what you set out to do, but how do you feel about the 5A amendment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Lynch, like I said earlier, I think this, at least, I think it's a good compromise, actually, right? I would be willing to support the 5A amendment.
I guess my concern is, you know, knowing that if this bill passes and something like this is in there, it wouldn't be signed into law until, say, May of 2010. Whether January 1 of 2011 would be enough time to get the word out to let you know, current legislators who are affected by this weigh their options. I don't know if that's enough time.
5 minutes would be enough.
5 minutes would be enough time? Okay. So you want to shorten it up? Okay. So we can give them until September 1st of this year. Okay. Well, I can do that, too. I'm
I think
okay.
That, yeah,
that's I just wanted to make sure I thought of it. Okay. 5 minutes. Okay. So Representative Kahn moves. Okay. Okay.
I don't think I accept that one.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the 5A amendment.
Okay. Sarah Lynch has moved the 5A amendment. Is there discussion on the 5A amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Prosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to say I'm not comfortable with trying to particularly deal with a fairness issue at this time, whether people perceive it to be fair or not. I still think there's going to be a lot of public perception of what the legislature is giving ourselves. Mm-hmm. During this time, and we are dealing with some really serious issues in this pension committee. And so not to say that this perhaps is a good idea at some point, I'm just not comfortable with it at this time.
Pension issues, I think, can be easily demagogued. I think that's a fair statement. It's very hard to explain the facts to the public. I mean, to try to explain to somebody, you know, why anybody would take a high five for a job that hasn't had one pay raise in the last 18 years of 5%. High five doesn't make a lot of sense for that. So, but we understand that. I don't know how you explain that to the public. It'd be fair. You're right, Senator Rosen. I mean, somebody could easily twist this around and throw things out there because they think that we get the same kind of benefits that members of Congress get, and that's not even close. But, Senator Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, I have a couple questions of Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Bergstrom? Welcome to the Pension Commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
You still have a motion.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom. I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bergstrom. I've been working toward the same goal that Representative Mahoney and Senator Tomasoni has been working for several years. Well, since 2002, probably. And during this whole time, with this whole discussion today and in the previous discussion, we never discussed the amount of money that goes from our legislative salaries into our pension fund. Am I correct that it's 9%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, for those in the legislator's plan, it is 9%. The unclassified plan is 4% employee and 6% employer.
Okay.
But for those in the legislator's plan, it is a 9% contribution rate.
And I think that should be put on that. I asked the question, so that's on the record. So 9% of the legislator's salary goes to the pension for their to cover their pension.
In the old plan.
In the old plan.
Right.
So I'm saying it's not a free ride. But, Mr. Chairman, I came in 1977 in the House of Representatives.
Or the old plan.
In the old plan.
Right.
And I was under that plan for 2 years right. then. And then I became part of the old plan because I did win election in 78. When I came in, there were 101 people in my House caucus. The next year in 79, there was a tie. So we went down from 101 down to 67, 66. And one of the main issues that created that great loss was the public's misinterpretation of the pension bill that changed from the old to the old plan. What we're talking about now is from the old to the old plan. And we changed the number of years that it took to vest from 10 to 6.
8 to 6.
Or 8 to 6. And that was perceived as a benefit. And we lost the old plan had better, for a longer period of time, a better payment benefit to those that were retired than the new old plan was did. But that was perceived as a benefit credit. So I think Senator Rosen should tell us again what she thinks. what you said before.
Well, if, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, if you lost seats, then I guess I'm for this plan.
It ain't going to happen that way. And Mr. Bergstrom, would you give your opinion of 5A and your... And if we missed anything that we should be considering under the discussion of the proposal that's before us without being amended.
And as you do, could you also describe, if somebody changed from unclassified to the defined benefit, how are those contributions treated that were made all through the first couple of years until somebody switched over to different plans? Mr. Bergstrom, any thoughts on this process?
Mr. Chair, first of all, how it would work. If someone switches from the unclassified plan to the general plan, existing employees, for example, we take the money, they contributed 4%, the employer paid 6%, and there are investment earnings and losses. When someone switches, we take those earnings and contribution and move them to the general plan, and if there's a deficiency, the general plan absorbs that. If there is a contribution rate difference, right now the employee contribution is 4, and in the unclassified plan, in the general plan, we've been moving up to 5, the employee does have to make up the difference in that contribution. So we transfer that from the unclassified individual's account to our general employee's retirement plan. To the question about the amendment, the concern MSRS had, which you addressed in the bill already, was the impact of people waiting until retirement to make the decision. So, and the concern was then we have sort of a guaranteed loss because people wait until the last minute, and if it's higher under the general plan, they switch. If it's higher under the unclassified plan, they stay. And the amendment seems somewhat consistent with that. One of the sort of thoughts that I had, and it really is kind of a political decision, it sounds like, whether you want to move forward or not. From what you did in the bill that we proposed, you gave employees 7 years to decide. And you talked just recently about a legislator who was elected with a special election. One other alternative might be to give, if you decide to do this, to give current legislators up to their seventh year of service, those 7 years, and then anybody with over 7 give this window that you've talked about. And the reasoning behind that is vesting. You know, we're proposing increasing vesting to 5 years, and it's hard to make a decision at 2 years whether you're going to be vested or not in our general employees retirement plan. So if you do decide to move ahead for future elected officials, I think I would put them under the same 7-year rule that everybody else is. For current legislators with under 7 years, you could give them to that seventh year to decide, and then for current legislators, you could say you have this time frame. That takes away the concern that MSRS has had with this last-minute decision, which has a great impact. Granted, there are risks and counseling involved. We would be happy to do that in that time frame. I know, for example, when I looked at Representative Mahoney's year and a half ago, his was a toss-up. You know, now it's probably a little easier to tell him which one's better, but I can't say that 2 years from now that it won't have been reversed. So, but it would seem that to make people with 1 year of service to decide, I think that's a little difficult. But that the bigger question is whether you want to move forward.
Yeah, Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Bergstrom, that was a good point that I could consider. And then do you have the numbers with you that Mr. Mahoney forgot?
Yep, I do. And I probably would have forgotten them in about another day as well. So Representative Mahoney asked me to look at the number of legislators who retired in the last 10 years or started to collect in those, so former legislators or legislators at the time. And we had 250. Of those 250, 49 of them had retired under a higher high five using combined service, and which is about 20, just under 20%. The second question I think that Representative Mahoney asked, I have not had time to research, and that was how many of those had just a few months, or was it their whole high five? And I did not look at that, but just off the top of my head, there were probably 10 to 15 that would have had some kind of a combined high five, maybe part legislator, part something else. But I don't have those exact numbers.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a pretty serious issues that we have to deal with, actually trying to fix TRA and a bunch of other things on the agenda for. And so we have all these amendments and stuff. I just think it might be useful to get a show of hands of who wants to even make any changes, whether it's the amendment or anything else, so we can at least get a sense of whether we're going anywhere with this discussion or not. I mean, I don't have a good sense of that. So,
Well, we have a pending amendment before us. If we took a vote, we'd have an idea where people are at.
Well, people might want to go with this amendment, but then not vote. You know, this may be an improvement, but then not ultimately vote.
I guess if you don't like the policy or the thought, just vote down the amendment. I suppose. Senator Lynch?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to remind us that we also, in a previous discussion on this issue or related issues, we did hear some testimony from Mr. Bicker on a suggestion of how we might make both of the in-play contributions at the same level. So I'm just reminding us of that conversation.
Can we call the question? Is that an appropriate motion?
Well, let's just, Representative Nelson, yeah.
As much as this question is about fairness between how you treat employees, and it just so happens that the employees that are being treated as second class in this situation is the legislature, the newer legislators that have been elected after this date. The whole thing, as we've talked about here, is a political thing, it'll be twisted around. I mean, it's the reason why we're in this place in the first place, is that there was rules that were put into place that, as a reaction to stuff that happened, I mean, there was an IRS 415S rule that was put into place because some senator retired or a couple of senators retired back then, and they were getting larger pensions than their legislative salaries were because they combined all their legislative pensions into one and got this. And that was put into effect, and it started affecting these people. Well, then the U.S. Senate, they took all the legislators out of it and then everybody else out of it. And at a point, it was only affecting people that in the building trades was on situation where they had good pensions, where they couldn't collect more out of their pension than they collected their last year that they worked. And so people who had long terms of service and maybe the last couple of years didn't work a lot of hours weren't able to collect their full pensions. Now, that's been eliminated also. It was eliminated under the last administration in Washington. But, again, that was done as a political knee-jerk reaction. And we're here, we've been elected to do things that are good for the state and good for the employees of the state. And we're all arguing about how it's going to affect our election. I guess this is what we're talking about here. And that's where we're at. I mean, we are being treated, the newer legislators, because of this pension plan, are being put in a severely less advantageous pension plan than every other employee we hire at the state of Minnesota. And I guess we're all talking about here in the terms of our political elections, and I guess I support the amendment. I think it's a good compromise, and I support the bill going forward. That's my position.
Okay. Does anybody I don't know if we've got the language, but the suggestion was made about giving people who have less than 7 years of legislative service, you know, additional time. Mr. Martin, do you have any suggestions on that?
Yes, members. If you did want to do that, if you turn to the 5A amendment on line 16, 1.16, after the word before, insert the end of the member's seventh year of legislative service or. And then after, I'm sorry, I'll repeat that. Line 1.16, after before, insert the end of the member's seventh year of legislative service or. And then after 2011, insert, comma, whichever is later.
Yeah. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if I understand what this amendment is doing. Anyone who is elected after 97 isn't going to be, you know, as things stand right now, isn't in the general plan where there's an opportunity to make an election back and forth anyway. So is what this amendment is doing is saying that you would now have the right to elect into that general plan?
Yes.
If you sometime within 7 years?
Yes.
Oh, well, isn't that going to have a financial impact on the pension? I mean, it seemed, I thought.
They have to pay the difference. They have to pay.
If you weren't making sufficient contributions, you'd have to pay. Mr. Bergstrom, they'd have to pay, right? That's what you said?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. They would have to make up the contribution difference from the 4% that's paid into the unclassified plan to the general plan. And the only reason I made this suggestion was it's, A, consistent with what you decided to do for employees going forward, and B, it is difficult to decide if you're not vested yet. It's a difficult decision to make if you don't know if you're even going to be serving to get the 3 years or 5 years you need. But that was the...
Mr. Martin.
Members, to fully do what Mr. Bergstrom had suggested, you also have to make the identical change down on page 1, line 28. The insertion after the word before and the insertion after the 2011 date.
Okay.
That gets it in both places.
Sir Lynch, you had moved the amendment. Did you want to incorporate that change? Okay, sir. The language would be incorporated in the Sir Lynch's amendment. Sir Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a couple more comments. You know, in principle, I agree with what Representative Nelson said, that everyone should be treated the same, and I think that's fair. But I think this is the wrong time at this point in our economy when people's pensions are in trouble and people are having to take lesser benefits to do something that sort of focuses on our pensions. But if we do this and this goes on, then I am going to offer the amendment that would address that goal, what I high-five issue when you're a political appointment and not being able to use your years in the legislature to pad your retirement through some type of a political appointed type of job. And so I just want everyone to know that I'm going to offer that amendment if we do this, so that we're not accused of doing something which in my mind is wrong, putting ourselves into a position where we could take advantage of that.
Representative Kahn.
I actually, at the time when we were making some of these, I offered that exact amendment too. So that people like the people whom we could see were going to do that would end up having just two separate distinct pension plans, the legislative pension plan, and then when they went into the executive branch, they would have their, they would then start all over again and have that as their
two separate plans. And Mr. Chair, Mr. Martin, that's what I had intended this to do, but I'm not sure if it exactly does that. It almost makes it seem like it eliminates your existing pension rather than, okay, well then fine, as long as it doesn't do that then.
No, member, well, if you offer it, I can go through it okay. In more detail. Probably is not appropriate to do that yet.
Any further discussion on the amendment? Okay, see no further discussion. Anybody else who's here wants to be heard on this amendment? Okay, the question occurs on the 5A amendment. All those in favor, as incorporated. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
As opposed, say no.
No.
No. The amendment prevails. Mr. Olson?
Mr. Chair, I have the 31-1A amendment.
Okay.
Senator, you have all the copies, so...
Sorry.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Raise your hand. Does anybody want to call for a division?
Division is what you need to do.
I mean, I voted yes.
I can only go on what I hear.
Yeah.
I voted no.
Don't. Let's not discuss.
We had enough here.
I didn't know.
Yeah. I heard no
one. I would have voted no.
Yes. I heard a sign.
I was reading about.
I should look this way. No one voted no. Let's see what happens.
Okay.
Perk it. Let it perk a little.
Charleston.
Mr. Chair, basically what this amendment does, or my understanding of what I hope this amendment does, and Mr. Martin can tell us, is to do just exactly what Representative Kahn was saying, that basically your pension benefit for your legislative years would be calculated, that portion of your pension based on your salary while you were in the legislature, and you'd be entitled to that. Then if you went in, but if you then went into a politically appointed job after that, you would restart your pension benefit calculation based on those years of service and that salary and put those two together. The only thing that I don't believe it does that I had intended for it to do is affect anyone who's in an existing job. I don't mean retroactively because I don't think legally we could do that, but going forward, I would prefer that they didn't get the benefit of that from this point forward for people who are already in those positions. Considering that there's only a year left before, there'll be another election, who knows. But I think if it's the right thing to do, it should be the right thing to do for everyone, both future appointments and people who are in existing positions.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the question I have, and maybe the staff could help me with this, if we do this, does this going to mean that they going into the new plan, they have to start out at ground zero and then get revested in that new plan, or would they be vested when they walked in, but if they would not be able to use that high five? They'd have their pension benefit on that one be calculated differently than it was two separate plans.
Members, most but not all public employees have a couple of routes to get portability. There is a service in more than one fund provision, which is different than the combined service annuity, and most plans, except for the judge's plan, I think all of the statewide plans and all the major local plans have, the first class A teachers and MRF have service in more than one fund provisions, which allows you to put together periods of time for vesting purposes. So with the exception of judges, whose only real portability is a combined service annuity, an individual who will be covered by this who can't use the combined service annuity could still vest with a combination of years of service that total three. And that's our vesting period for almost all of our plans. So judges would have to get a full 10. Okay. So a legislator who became a judge who only got 9 would have trouble, but because there is no service in more than one fund provision in the judge's plan.
Mr. Fleming, you're at the table. Did you have something to weigh in on this?
I do. Mr. Chairman, Morgan Fleming. I'm normally here on behalf of middle management or other employee representative groups. I'm just here as a civilian, Morgan Fleming. Years ago in the early 70s, 71 or 2, I was one of three staffers in the minority staff in the Minnesota Senate, the Democrats. And in the 72 election, they did a lot of changes, and one was annual sessions in the legislature, and there was a long discussion before that went on. I remember I was young, a pup. But no one imagined then, nobody imagined that legislators would be spending as much time as they are now when they're elected. It just never came up. I remember in 1978 I had the good fortune of being a treasurer for the U.S. Senate candidate and a congressional candidate named Sabo, and I remember that campaign. And I remember going across the Iron Range with Wendy Anderson was a candidate, and Ted Kennedy was back with him. And the demonstrations were horrible, not because legislators' pensions. Probably one of the reasons Don Fraser didn't win the primary was because of the boundary waters matter. And there were other matters. And you remember in the 70 election that the incumbent Governor Perpich lost and the incumbent U.S. Senator Wendy Anderson lost, and then David Durenberger won the Senate seat. And legislators, things happened in the House, and legislators lost. There was a labor leader named Allers that made a career out of trying to make the pension issue an issue in those House campaigns. Putting that aside, if this was a ERISA plan, there isn't such a thing as a PERISA. If this is an ERISA plan by the Department of Labor, U.S. Department of Labor, and please correct me, Larry Martin, that one of the cornerstones of that, there shall be no discrimination in the plan. You can't have a company of 300 employees and the management does well and the other employees get nothing. That's not a qualified plan. And I just think even I remember members of the House. I remember a Democrat representative from Anoka County served a long time, appointed by a Republican governor to be commissioner of finance, among other things, and acknowledged probably other than Gus Dunhow to be the best commissioner of finance in the last 25 years, and still called back and asked to help. You know, so just because somebody has served in the legislature, and the matter of not having increase in pay for 13 years is strange. Yeah, I know that if middle manager or any of the bargaining units that happened to them, they would be pouting and shouting and complaining and all that going on. So I just say that that every once in a great while there's somebody that in the legislature that may be picked to serve at a higher level, and they shouldn't be discriminated against because they spent some years being in the legislature. You confirm them when they're nominated and stuff. And I just say that as a, just an observer over time. Excuse me.
Sarah Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I tend to always have the unfortunate thing of seeing both sides. And while I don't disagree with what you say, and I understand ERISA principles and how that works with general retirement policies, the difference in this situation to me is that the people that this bill is directed to get at are people who are political appointees. And, well, we heard that 20% of former legislators have gotten a higher retirement because of this rule and the way that this is happening right now. What we didn't hear is how many people are in positions right now who have not yet retired who are going to benefit from this. And I'm guessing that in another, whenever the party changes and those appointments change, you're going to see another very large group of people with regard to who are in those positions today. And I'm not sure, I'm not pointing a finger at any particular party, because it could very well be that the same situation would be true in either direction. But I guess I try to think about this in terms of what would seem reasonable to someone in the public. And it seems to me that I agree with you. I think it's not fair to legislators any more than anyone else that someone doesn't have an adequate salary for the amount of work that they're doing in terms of any raises, and we don't do that to anyone else. But on the flip side of the coin, it seems to me that there's too much of a potential carrot out there for someone to be politically appointing someone for the reason of that person's your friend in the legislature, now you're the governor, that you've known them, you want to reward them, whatever. And to be able to do that through kind of a backdoor means of using a pension benefit and greatly enhancing what it would have otherwise been, I just think that's hard to justify. It seems to me that also we want to make sure that people who are selected as commissioners and deputy commissioners are done, that that's done for the right reason, that that person is chosen because they are the best person for the job with the most knowledge about that department. I mean, maybe that sounds sort of naive, but I really think that's, we want to put incentives in our financial system to allow that to happen or to make it more likely that that will happen. And so I think that expecting someone to have a pension based on the years of service that they spent at the salary they were expending it, whether it was, you know, an artificially low salary or not, that's what that person expected and anticipated while they were in that job. If they're then given an appointment at a much higher level, they should expect to have that portion of their pension be determined based on that much higher salary, and that seems fair to me. But allowing something that wouldn't normally happen within the course of employment, where you normally work yourself up one step at a time, this really huge change in salary, which with a really huge change in a pension benefit as a result because of a political appointment, to me is hard to explain to the public.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the courtesy. I just make the comment, and I respect your remarks. It's just I thought I'd make it as a person, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
I have a question, Mr. Martin. In 311A, is it my understanding then that a person that was in the old plan and defined benefit plan would have a legislative salary for however they picked? And then if they got an appointment in 311A, they would be in a defined contribution plan for their years that they were commissioner or whatever.
Ms. Martin?
Someone who's appointed to a agency head position has the choice, like anyone in the unclassified plan, of either being in the MSRS general plan or in the unclassified plan at the within the first year of being hired or being employed. So they could be in the unclassified plan. They would not have to be in the unclassified plan. And the combined service annuity works optimally if you're in a defined benefit plan for both. It can work. The unclassified plan is one of the included plans under the combined service annuity, and so if you have a very high salary, even though you don't have service credit, you can use the salary. So even if someone who is appointed a commissioner and chose to stay in the unclassified plan, they could still utilize their salary in the unclassified plan in computing the high five for their prior service. So it works maybe best if you have a defined benefit plan and both pieces, but it can work even if you added unclassified plan coverage at the second piece, the last piece, and a high salary.
Thank you for that clarification.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and members, this amendment was not the amendment that I came here to talk about. And as you choose to do it, you're going to be fine with that. But I would like to take task with Senator Olson. That's awfully insulting, what you said about anyone who takes a job in government, whether it's in the Department of Ed, Health, Admin, at the governor's office. To think that a governor would appoint someone stupid to a position just so they could fix their high five. I hope, whether it's a governor in the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, I hope the voters of the state of Minnesota would elect someone with an awful lot more integrity than what you implied.
Mr. Chair. And I try to say that, you know, it's worked out to some people's advantage, you know, to have applied their years of legislative service, you know, to another position. And I don't know that any of them did it because of the pension benefits. But the trouble is, I don't know how you explain that to the public, because I said this is an easy issue to demagogue. This is a real easy issue to throw out to the public. I mean, I think the issue that Representative Murphy was referring to was that in the 78 elections, and there, as Mr. Fleming said, there was other issues going on in 78. But I think there were ads basically said, you know, incumbent legislators can get a pension after 6 years. And it sounded like, you know, a good deal. Well, if you've only served 6 years in the legislature, and that's it, you will get a pension. It ain't going to be worth squat. I mean, it's going to be a very small pension. But so, I mean, it was technically right, but it was misleading as all get out. So, but anyway, Sarah Olson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, you know, sometimes when a person says something, perhaps the person hearing it has an impression of what someone's trying to say, and I tried to say it carefully, but perhaps I didn't say it as carefully as I should have. I did not say what anyone's thinking or what anyone has done, what their motive would be. How would I know that? But I do know as a lawyer that it's important that we have laws that give not only that are fair, but have the appearance of fairness. And appearances and perceptions are sometimes almost as important as the underlying rationale for something. So having what I said was that we should not have a system designed that has, I think what I said, the appearance of or incentives for something, and on their face value, that's there under the existing system. Doesn't mean that's why someone is doing that, but there is a financial benefit that seems hard to explain and justify, and so there's the possibility of a perception that we're giving the public when we do this, and I think we ought to remove those kinds of potential rewards that are in place in our system right now that would be hard to explain or justify.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I have a question or two of the author of the proposed amendment. I've heard the author use the phrase political appointment a few times. I do not see that in the amendment itself anywhere defined. So what I'd like to know is specifically, and this may be a two-part question, what do you classify as a political appointment? Specifically, is it anybody, any legislator that is appointed by a governor to any position of employment?
And would that include a judgeship as an example?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sarah Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was my intent, to have it drafted. I'm not saying that I'm not intending a negative connotation by using the word political. It's just I use that to describe what I'm talking about here, which is a person who is appointed through a political process, an appointment by the governor, as opposed to someone who is promoted from within by a supervisor.
Mr. Chairman, so specifically with regards to a judge, for example, since the chairman used that process before the governor makes an appointment goes through a judicial selection committee or commission, mm-hmm. and weans out the qualified. You would also, as maker of this amendment, consider that to be a political appointment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, yes, it is. That doesn't mean, I'm not saying, as I said before, political implies some kind of negative connotation. It simply means that a person who would have the benefit of an appointment like that, a person who is appointed, would get a retirement benefit from that point forward for their service that would be based on their higher salary. But they would not be able to use the years of service that they spent at a much lower salary to enhance, under the high five rule, their pension benefit perhaps several times over. The pension they earned before as a legislator, they would still be entitled to at the salary that they earned it at that time. So in other words, if they weren't expecting that there was going to be a future appointment, they're not really losing anything. They're still getting the pension they would be entitled to that they had earned as a legislature, and then they would get the benefit of the pension that they earned at that higher salary for the number of years they worked there.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Smith,
I understand you're trying to keep a certain class of people at a lower pension when they go to realize the pension. What I'm trying to get at here, in my mind, but also for the record that we're making on the tape, is what you consider the author of this amendment to be a political appointment. For example, I understand, it's my understanding from what I've heard that any person, any legislator, former legislator picked by the governor and appointed to any job is a political appointment, would be so limited by this amendment if it was adopted. Do you also consider, for example, If a commissioner who has been appointed by a governor becomes a commissioner of a commission and then later hires a former legislator, is that legislator a political, considered a political appointee?
Mr. Martin? Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
I guess I would ask Mr. Martin, under the definition of the way that this is drafted, whether that would be encompassed or not.
Mr. Martin?
Members, I'm sorry. The current amendment does not actually restrict itself to individuals who are appointed by the governor, but is actually drafted more broadly than that. I was trying to work out the language that would restrict it to a gubernatorial appointment situation when you were asking me that question, and I wasn't focused on your conversation. I'd be happy to answer the question, but I didn't hear it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I will restate the question because I think there's different routes by which a former legislator may become a state employee. If the governor appoints our state representative as cherry picks him out of the House caucus and appoints him commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, as has been done in recent memory, my understanding is under this amendment, that person is a political appointee and would be limited to their legislative pension.
No.
Would be affected by this amendment.
Yes.
All right.
Yes, I think so.
My question is, where, at what point, my question is this, is a former state legislator who is not appointed directly by the governor but is hired by a commissioner to become a state employee who was appointed by the governor, is that person affected by this amendment?
Mr. Chair? I think this is affecting any legislator going into future government service of any kind. And so when I said appointment, I was talking about that in terms of, you know, the concern that I have in bringing this amendment forward. But I think, you know, basically the same argument holds true whether you're talking about someone directly appointed by the governor or someone that commissioner chose to be a part of their staff, would probably, you know, with the concurrence of a governor, especially at higher level positions. But in any event, you know, the idea here is that you get what you expected as a legislator, and you're not going to lose that, but that you're not going to, if you go into a much higher paying position, be able to use those years of service to substantially enhance your pension benefit.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I understand that, but what I'm trying to get at on the record, Mr. Martin, is any former legislator who is hired by a commissioner, not appointed by the governor directly, but hired in any capacity to be a state employee after they complete their legislative tasks, are they affected by this amendment?
Yes, and
Ms. Martin.
Yes, the 031-1A amendment would apply no matter how the person shifted from legislative service to subsequent state employment.
So then one senator could classify this amendment as the don't apply for a state job after you're a state legislator amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
I guess, Representative Smith, you'd only feel that way if you expected that your time in the legislature was going to lead to another appointment. I don't think any of us have that expectation. We'd still be entitled to the same pension benefit working in later government service that we would have had if we had come in from the private sector.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
No further questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Sir Pappas.
Just how far-reaching was it? Say, what if a legislator left and then took a job as a full-time faculty member at a Minsky institution? They would have to, their pension year would have to start over. It would be a separate pension for them as well.
Except for vesting.
Except for vesting. It wouldn't be
members, most IRAP, most Minsky faculty are covered by IRAP, a defined contribution plan, and the combined service annuity doesn't apply to them. So in that circumstance, they would have their legislator's pension calculated separate from their subsequent Minsky, not by virtue of this, but by virtue of our current arrangement of our pension coverage.
Sir Tomasoni, welcome to the Pension Commission. How are you?
Chairman, thank you. Maybe this is why I haven't asked to be on the Pension Commission. But, Mr. Chairman, I just looking around this table, and I think that, and I realize I don't have a vote on this amendment, but I just look around this table and I see Representative Murphy, Representative Kahn, Representative Smith, Senator Betzel, Senator Pappas. It's kind of like saying, well, your years of service here haven't been appreciated, and so therefore we're not going to count them if you do go into someplace else in government. And I quite frankly think that the public service that we do is pretty darn valuable to the, not only to the public, but to the people that we have to serve as a result of what we do. And I think Representative Mahoney brought some numbers out that indicate that the people who do utilize that particular provision of the pension benefits is very, very minimal, and that they don't go on to be a commissioner because they're going to get their high five up. They go on because they've been called to another type of public service. And to say that what you've done here in the legislature shouldn't count, I think is not appropriate.
Senator Lynch, I think we should get moving on other issues soon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, the amendment that's before us affects current legislators and legislators going forward, correct?
Yes. If there's service after the effective date of the act, or the effective date of the section, which is final enactment or June 30th, 2010, which section you're talking about.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Martin, if I may. So just to be clear, so the amendment before us and the change contained within it would, in fact, impact Representative Murphy, Representative Kahn, no. And all of those that are currently serving.
Mr. Martin?
Members, yes, if they have service after the effective date of the act, which is likely to, well, after final enactment or June 30th, yes.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lynch, yeah.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Then back for the commission, back to our principles of pension policy, number 22. It's on page 3. No intended ultimate benefit diminutions. There are two sections here. In recommending benefit plan modifications, the imposition of reductions in overall benefit coverage for existing pension plan members should not be recommended. It goes on to say a reduction in some aspect or aspects of benefit coverage may be recommended in combination with a proposed benefit increase or benefit increases in implementing sound pension policies. I'm just merely pointing out that the impact of the 1A amendment is, in fact, diminishing pension benefit.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, in terms of who's affected by this amendment that I'm offering, my understanding is based on the last amendment, which I voted against, but which we passed, that this amendment that I'm offering now affects all of us, because now we're all in the same boat, from what I understand, or at least we have the option to be. So I'm certainly not intending this as directing it against any particular members, and in fact, that's why I wasn't offering this amendment unless that amendment had gone on. But now that it has, and we're all in the same boat, potentially, I guess that we are limiting something in a future benefit if we pass this amendment, but limiting it only in accord to what we say that people aren't looking for anyway. And I think, again, that it is hard to justify, because someone gets into those positions outside of the normal course of progression through the workplace.
Is there further discussion on the 1A amendment? Seeing none, the question occurs on the 1A amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
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 The motion does not prevail. Is there further discussion on Senate File 1407, House File 1358? Anybody else want to be heard on this issue? Senator Lynch?
Mr. Chair, I have a 6A amendment.
Okay.
Members, while the 6A amendment is coming out, I can explain what it does.
What this amendment does, this deals with the MSRS on classified plan, and rather than having the employee contribution set at 4% of salary as in current law, it would instead be tied to the contribution rates as specified for the MSRS general plan.
What would that mean? Or maybe Mr. Bergstrom, or somebody can explain to us what that means. Mr. Bergstrom.
Money out of my salary. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. I don't know if you've seen the amendment. I'm not quite sure what the effect is.
Okay, Mr. Chair, what the effect would be, as I understand the amendment, is that it would tie the contribution rates of the unclassified plan to our contribution rates to the general employees retirement plan. So existing are as current people in this plan, effectively their contribution rate would go from 4% to 5% if it's effective July 1 of 2010, because that's our last rate put in. This actually used to be tied together. We did have the contribution rates tied together, and back when we implemented our contribution rates, they were separated. It has some advantages in that people then who ultimately switch, we don't have to go back and bill them for the additional contribution rates, because and that's what it is trying to get at. Because now we go back and bill them for whatever they missed in those contribution rates. But it would, just so everybody understands, it would increase contribution rates for current employees. I think the policy makes sense. I liked them when they were tied together. At worst, it allows people to save more for their retirement, because now they're contributing more. But that would be the only perception and, would be the.
And as we've discussed and will be discussing very soon, we make increases in the employer and the employee contribution rates. Does this kicks in with that?
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding. Would kick in with that.
Okay.
Now MSRS in its bill is not proposing that. We phased in our contribution rates, from 2007 through 2010.
Right.
But that's not to say we wouldn't come back in the future. And likewise, if we lower them someday, it would pull them back.
Okay. So discussion on the 6A amendment. Senator Lynch has moved the 6A amendment. Anybody else want to be heard on the motion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Any other? Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be appropriate to hear from Representative Mahoney and Senator Tomasoni.
Anybody else want to be heard?
Mr. Chairman, I think I looked at that schedule actually in the statute, and I don't normally open those books, but I think it's probably an appropriate thing to do.
So it goes from 4 to 5. That's the
okay,
Mr. Chair. Is that right,
Representative Thiessen? Yeah.
4 to 5.
4 to 8%, which effective right now would be currently be 5. So okay. Further discussion on the amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Okay. Anything further on Senate File 1407, House File 1358? Is there a motion to consider it for the omnibus bill?
Members.
Just a moment.
Senator, if I could, there were two.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Technical or virtually technical amendments.
Okay.
There's a 1A and a 2A amendments. In looking at the bill, I think I can demonstrate the problem. If you look on page 13 of the memo of the bill, this is the actual bill itself, and you look at page 1, line 10, there's a clauses 2 through 18 are going to be included in this. During the first year, you can opt into MSRS unclassified coverage. Then by the time you get down to 1.22, you see that people referenced in clause 15 have some different treatments, and that is somewhat problematic in saying everybody's in, but then somebody isn't in. And so what 1A does is restructures it so that the folks who really aren't intended, the clause 15 folks, these are judges, long service judges. Oh. I don't know how you handle them in any event, trying to figure out what their first year of service is, but it cleans that up, and it's intended to be technical.
That was addressed in the memo. That's correct.
And yeah. So that's the 1A amendment.
Is there a motion on the 1A?
So I move.
Representative Murphy moved the 1A amendment. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. 1A amendment is adopted. Mr. Martin.
And the 2A amendment is, again, the same group of folks, the long-service judges, and whether or not it's intended that these folks be included in the opportunity to shift with 10 years of service credit to MSRS general plan coverage. If you look on page 4, it is clear that constitutional officers who are the Clause 1 folks can't, but it doesn't mention anything about judges. And so I don't know if you folks want to really have judges who are in the unclassified plan who get 10 years of service and then jump to the general plan for a portion of their coverage that wasn't part of what you had proposed to do back about a decade ago when you added long service judges into the unclassified plan. So I
this has been a headache enough without getting into the judicial part of it. Mr. Burstyn, did you have anything you want to tell us?
Mr. Chair, our view would be to not let judges switch. What happens with judges, they're pretty unique. And it was an adjustment that was made, 8-10 years ago. Judges have a cap on their pensions of 24 years of service. After they hit that cap, their employee contributions only go into the unclassified plan. And to allow them to switch, they haven't contributed the full amount. And really, that was not the intention of that. It was just a separate account to help build up for their employee. The employer contributions stay in the judge's plan in order to pay off the unfunded liability.
The amendment, I think, is what he's supporting. This would clarify, that just like constitutional officers, that the judges can't make the transfer, which could be the negative implication of not specifying them on the top of page 4.
Sure. And Senator Tomasoni and Representative Mahoney, you didn't want to bring judges into this discussion.
Absolutely not.
Is there a motion?
Okay.
So moved.
Okay. Representative moves the 2A amendment. Further discussion on that. Hearing all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion fails. Further discussion on the bills. Is there a motion to adopt them into the omnibus bill?
So moved.
Representative Kahn moves that Senate File 1407, House File 1358, as amended, be incorporated in the omnibus bill. Is there a discussion on that motion? Anybody else want to be heard? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Come back anytime.
Members.
And again, by the way, for the record, I wrote a letter to the governor encouraging him to appoint Senator Neville to the bench. So don't anybody ever suggest that anything I said. No, I respected him. I'm glad he's a judge. And not bring up a bunch of floor amendments up anymore. So, I mean, no, I want him to be on the bench, and I did what I could to get him appointed somewhere.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
I hope that my comments aren't interpreted by anyone as being directed at any particular person. I'm just talking about the way we're designing a system and, you know, the designing it in a way that is would appear fair, and that's my opinion regarding it. It's not toward any one person.
Okay.
That's good.
I think
Mr.
we'll,
Chairman,
we'll, sir,
when I proposed it years ago, I was directing it at particular people.
Senator Olson's come
a
long way.
any names that we recognize?
I won't say them now.
Yeah. We'll probably go past 1 o'clock, obviously, since we got started late. We will not go beyond 2 o'clock because I have some matters that I'm sure other people have to get the road to. So, well, does that work for people if we go until at least 2? Okay. All right, so let's go back. Number 2 on the agenda, LCPR 10-005, MSRS Retirement-Related Administrative Provisions. Mr. Burke.
Members, it's been on the agenda a few times, and we at least started discussion on it at a prior meeting. The -005 draft is the MSRS admin provisions, and Section 1 of that dealt with some revisions to seasonal employee language. Change there would essentially put all seasonal employees in the plan rather than just Department of Revenue seasonal employees. That provision did seem to be purely technical in that one can argue fairly conclusively that these other seasonal employees would be in the plan anyway due to other provisions of law. So this change here does seem to be purely Section 2 was one of several sections in this bill that simply deletes the word state from any reference to the state deferred compensation plan. So that's purely technical. Section 3 was the reemployed annuitant provision. This is MSRS General. And the change here was not controversial. The change of substance was on page 4, in paragraph F. We have all new language. Basically, what this was intended to do was to allow individuals who were public safety employees, retired public and safety employees. There was some language passed a few years back that allowed those individuals to have amounts taken out of their retirement annuity by the retirement plan, and those amounts would be directed to insurance carriers on behalf of the retiree. And what this new language does on page 4 is it allowed, it changed that procedure somewhat to handle cases where, because of reemployment, the annuity had to cease and be redirected to an account for the individual. What this language does is it allows enough of the annuity to continue to be paid through simply to cover the insurance benefits that are necessary. And so that allows enough money to continue to go through so that the public employee plan can has some money to, in fact, redirect to the insurance carrier. I had suggested an amendment here that would have expanded that a bit to allow redirection to the PEEP program. MSRS indicated was not interested in that. However, Ms. Vanek from the executive director of PARA indicated that there was one amendment that I had prepared that she was interested in, and basically that amendment would create the same kind of coverage that is created under Section 3 here, would create that same coverage for PARA.
I'll tell you what, this bill, it's got a lot of different provisions in it. We did kind of go through it. I've got my handwriting all through all these amendments and so forth. Would it make sense if we just kind of went section by section and adopted them, and you know, as we go through them? I've typically done that with some of these bills.
Okay, that would make sense.
And maybe that would make sense, Mr. Bergstrom. We might have to refresh the members' memories on what's going on here. But did you have any other comments on this before we start running through this?
Mr. Chair, no. We did go through the bill. The only hang up, and it is mostly technical. The hang up we ran into was the correction of errors.
Right.
And I think we have worked that detail out.
Okay.
That was the 7A amendment, the 78A amendment. Okay. Why don't we just, again, we had a presentation on most of this. So Section 1, what does Section 1 do here?
Section 1 revises the seasonal employee language to make it more universal rather than limiting it to simply Department of Revenue employees.
Do you want to move them one at a time?
Yeah, why don't we do that? Because we got a lot of different things in this. And it's, now, the 1A amendment would remove that. So, okay.
Mr. Chairman, the 1A amendment does not seem to be necessary.
Okay. Okay, so is there a desire to move the Section 1 of the bill? Is there a motion?
No.
Okay, Senator Pappas moves Section 1 on the motion. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Section 2.
Section 2 is a non-controversial provision, just deleting state where anywhere where we have a reference to the state deferred compensation plan.
Okay.
MSRS wanted this because they claimed it was somewhat confusing to employees who can be covered by this because this plan is actually open not only to state employees but to teachers and local government employees and so on. So we just make it more generic.
Motion to adopt Section 2. So Representative Kahn moves Section 2. Discussion of that motion. Hearing of those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Section 2 is adopted. Number 3.
Section 3 I have just been discussing, and the language that is here does not appear to be controversial, but Ms. Vanek had indicated at a prior meeting that she was interested in an amendment that would provide treatment comparable to this for her plan. And that would be the dash 3A amendment.
And as we're going through this, if anybody, you know, we get to a section, somebody wants to be heard on, please come to the table. Ms. Vanek, on Section 3, we've got a 3A amendment. Do you have any thoughts on that? My notes from before say PERA supports. Ms. Vanek, welcome to the Pension Commission.
Mr. Chair, members, I thought we resolved this. So
I could just let you do the withholding for your public safety.
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, yes, we would like this amendment, 3A.
So 3A, you would like that, which ties into Section 3 of the bill?
It's the same substance.
Same substance, okay. Representative Nelson moves a 3A amendment. A discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. 3A amendment's adopted. Anything further on Section 3 that we need to discuss? Anybody else want to be heard on? Is there a motion to adopt Section 3 as amended? Okay, Representative Kahn moves Section 3 as amended. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Section 3 is adopted. Section 4.
Members, Section 4 is simply another provision where we're deleting the state, wherever it appears in the
I've written technical here, so is there a motion to adopt Section 4?
I'll move it.
Sarah Pappas moves it. Section 4. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Section 5.
Members, Section 5 is a revision to the a deferred compensation plan provision, the state deferred compensation plan provision, as we refer to in current law, dealing with the right to participate in the plan. And the language that is here makes it more general by not requiring a written agreement, but allowing other forms of agreements. And by changing public employer to plan sponsor. At the prior meeting, I had suggested an amendment because plan sponsor is not a term that's defined anywhere in the law. Mr. Bergstrom had testified saying that he preferred to keep the term plan sponsor because that was consistent with the various documents related to the plan, which they have. What occurred, though, was after the meeting, I had suggested an amendment to Mr. Bergstrom, which he felt was a good compromise on this. And that would be an amendment which I should have here. That would be the dash 24A amendment.
Okay.
And it would replace Section 4 that is in the bill with section, a revised Section 4.
Section 5, actually.
Section
5. Yeah, we adopt to Section 4, which is technical. This is, well, wait a minute. Page 4.
All right, what did I do here? Hold on.
Section 4. It's supposed to be delete Section 5.
Mr. Chairman, we do need a correction to this. On the amendment, page 1, line 3, mm-hmm. should be page 4, delete section 5,
okay.
and insert.
Gotcha, okay.
And on 1.4,
it's
right
here.
No, I don't think so.
I'm sorry.
Is what you want to kill off. I think you're extending plan sponsor more broadly.
Shouldn't pay attention to what people say. Oh, it's both 4 and 5.
This amendment does do Section 4,
yeah,
not 5.
To another provision.
It's the same, though, as Section 4.
Yeah.
Except plan sponsor on page 115. It's both 4 and 5.
We'll tell you what.
I'm sorry. Mr. Bergstrom, was this the amendment that you wanted? I've got a feeling that we copied the wrong amendment here.
Mr. Chair, I think it is, and I think it would be Section 4.
So you want us to reconsider Section 4?
Yep. Mr. Chair, I think that would go into Section 4.
Okay.
So I think the amendment is correct as drafted.
Okay, is there a motion to reconsider Section 4, then?
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah?
It looks to me that the difference between the one we just adopted and the amendment is simply on Section C, adding the words,
plan sponsor.
Yes.
Maybe we can just,
add that.
If we adopt the 24A amendment, that would accomplish it, I think.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, is there a motion to adopt the 24A amendment? Senator Pappas moves the 24A amendment. Discussion that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. The 24A amendment is adopted. Mr. Burke, on Section 5.
Okay, so Section 5, there would be no need for any change, presumably.
Okay. Everybody want to be heard on Section 5? Is there a motion to adopt Section 5?
So moved.
Senator Lynch moves Section 5. Discussion of the motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Section 5 is adopted. Section 6.
Sections 6
and 7,
seven
I think.
And 8,
eight yeah.
are part of a package, can
right.
be considered part of a package. They revise various provisions in the MSRS State Patrol Plan. And the most significant change there is Section 7, which would create a provision in the State Patrol Plan which would allow employees of labor organizations, if they have been covered by the State Patrol Plan, go on a leave to take a position with a labor organization representing those employees, would allow them to continue to be covered by the State Patrol Plan for that service by making the contributions that are required here. This type of provision is found in other MSRS plans and in the plans of various other pension systems.
Can
so
I ask
it's not.
Mr. Bergstrom, one question.
Sure. Yeah, and the note that I have from before is MSRS General already has this. Mr. Martin.
Yeah.
Mr. Bergstrom, what happens if an individual who's on this leave and is employed by a labor union becomes disabled? What's the standard that you're going to use? Is it inability to perform the duties of a state patrol officer, or what?
Mr. Bergstrom.
Since you have an occupational definition of disability in the plan.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Martin, I don't think I thought about that. It's the duties of the job, so I would believe you would have to apply it to the duties that they are currently I'm not sure. I have to think of the answer. I would have to think through that.
Representative Nelson.
Could you move the microphone?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just thinking about this because a person could become disabled and not be able to do the straight patrol job, but could still do the union job. Does that open a can of worms, I guess? Is that the question we're looking at here? And then what
members, we just revamped the State Patrol duty and non-duty disability last year, trying to make sure that individuals who have duty disabilities are actually fully duty-oriented or related disabilities. And when you add individuals who are not doing law enforcement to a law enforcement plan, or retain them, which is what this is doing, you have that problem, and that's why I asked the question. Maybe Mr. Bergstrom needs to come back to us with some additional language about disability determinations before you finalize work on the 2010 omnibus bill to try and address this point.
Yep. Mr. Chair,
the best way to resolve it.
Mr. Chair, I think that's a good idea. As I'm thinking about it, they would, if someone got injured on this job, it would not qualify for duty related, but would rather qualify for, they would still be eligible for non-duty related, just kind of piecing the laws together. But if you are comfortable with that, I can come back and look at that.
We should think about that one.
I will ponder that. Mr. Chair, quite frankly, I hadn't thought of that. Okay. We duplicated the language we have in our general plan in this. So.
I move adoption of Section 7.
At Section 6, 7, and 8 go
6,
together.
6, 7,
right?
And 8.
Yeah. Representative Murphy moves adoption of 6, 7, 8 discussion. Anybody else want to be heard? Hearing none. Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, I just would like to support further clarification on that before we close this up, particularly in light of the work that has been most recently completed.
We're going to have a run through the omnibus bill before it leaves the Pension Commission and goes on its way in the both bodies. So there'll be opportunities to revisit some things that, you know, have been kind of set aside but are going to be looked at before we take a final vote on the bill. So. Okay. Representative Murphy moves Section 6, 7, and 8. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Section 6, 7, and 8 are adopted. Section 9, correction of errors. We did have some amendments, one that MSRS proposed, but let's see. What's the discussion on Section 9?
Member, Section 9 is another provision for the State Patrol plan, and this provision would set up a procedure in the plan for correcting errors of coverage where an individual is covered by the wrong plan. This particular section is the section that triggered discussion at the prior meeting that rather than doing this piecemeal in different ways in different plans, what we needed was a provision that would create a more uniform policy to be followed by all the plans in these situations. So what I would suggest to you is to skip over Section 9 for now, because a later amendment, the 18A amendment, which provides a uniform procedure for correcting these kinds of errors, would include language that removes this. So I suggest skipping it for now.
We had discussed having one set of requirements instead of having each one having a different way of doing it. So, okay, Section 10.
Section 10 revises a restriction provision for supplemental pension plans.
I've got a note on it's just not required by federal law. That was at the end of Section 10. So.
Right. And
I think we heard some Ms. Vanek or somebody. We heard some testimony last time. Mr. Bergstrom, you said it wasn't required. So.
Mr. Chair, right. It was actually my fault. We thought they could not belong, and then we found an old ruling that said they could participate. So this just goes back to letting them to participate.
Okay. Is a motion to adopt Section 10?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Murphy moves it to Section 10. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Section 10 stops. Section 11.
Section 11 revises the annuity repayment provision within the wrongful discharge provision that was added to Chapter 356 several years ago. The argument for removing the language is that it seems to be redundant or unnecessary.
And this is a situation where an employee is wrongfully discharged, starts drawing an annuity, and then is reinstated.
Right.
Okay, so.
And Mr. Chair, the first half of that we're keeping says they have to repay it.
Right.
And then it talks about, well, if they don't repay it. And we do require them to repay anything, any pension they have received. So if I am discharged and I apply for retirement and then I'm reinstated, we make them pay back their pension because they're also getting salary for that time. So, but it seemed to be a conflicting statute, and the second half seemed unnecessary because the first half said they have to pay it.
Discussion, is there a motion from Section 11?
So moved.
Representative Elson, move Section 11. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion prevails. Now, correction of records. We skipped over Section 9. Errors. Correction of errors.
Right. Mr. Chairman, members, also attached you have the Dash 18A amendment and a memo that I did on this amendment. This memo and an amendment and the various amendments to the amendments, the amendment that I prepared for this, replaces the Dash 12A amendment that's been in your packet for the last few meetings to address some revisions that the pension plans wanted. What the 18A amendment does is it creates a uniform procedure that any of the MSRS, PARA, TRA, and First Class City Teacher plans would follow if there has been an error in coverage involving two defined benefit plans. And it also addresses some issues that are found in the laws of the particular plans dealing with transfers to correct errors between the defined benefit plan and certain defined contribution plans. Basically, what the procedure would be for correcting errors between defined benefit plans, and that is found in language in the 18A amendment, which is referred to as a new section 356.99. Basically, when an error is found, it has to be corrected in all cases for prospective coverage. That leaves the question of what do we do with the past coverage that has been placed in the incorrect plan. And the procedure that the pension plans wanted is to follow a rule that if the error first occurred within the current fiscal year or two prior fiscal years, then we will correct the past coverage error. If not, we will leave that past coverage in the wrong plan. So in cases where the past service must be corrected, the procedure the pension plan administrators agreed to amongst themselves was that they would simply take the contributions that were in the erroneous plan and transfer those contributions over to the correct plan without any interest. Now, if the contributions were not sufficient because the correct plan has higher contribution rates than the erroneous plan, then the employer would be required to come up with the additional amounts that are necessary, and the employer would have to transfer that additional amount to the correct plan. If there was an excess because the correct plan has lower contribution rates than the incorrect plan, then any excess employee contributions would be refunded to the employee with whatever rate of interest is specified in the plan's refund provision. And any excess employer contribution would be refunded to the employer by means of a crediting process. And if there was a problem of plan qualification that prohibited using transfers as just described, then what would happen is the employer would make the entire transfer and the employer would be reimbursed by a credit against future contributions. The main advantage of the process is simply simplicity. And I indicate to you in a memo that the procedure has some flaws. The first of them being that there is no interest on transfers from one plan to another or from the employer to the correct plan. You can envision three actors in this process. One is the employer who put the individual in the wrong plan. The other actor is the plan that received the contributions erroneously, so it's the erroneous plan. And the third actor being the plan that should have provided the coverage. Now, when we have transfers without interest, there's a problem in it. That system would certainly not give the employer any incentive to be a little more careful in the future. There's certainly no penalty for having made the error. The second thing is that the plan that received the contributions erroneously, the erroneous plan, gets a windfall because when the error is eventually discovered, the contributions are transferred over, but the erroneous plan gets to keep all the investment earnings on those contributions prior to the plan, prior to the transfer. And finally, the correct plan, the plan that should have provided coverage all along, gets shortchanged in this process because it gets the contributions, but it loses the investment earnings that it would have had if the contributions had arrived in a timely manner. So one of the amendments that I suggest to you is an amendment that would add a requirement that interest be paid on these transfers. The other thing I would point out.
Which amendment is that one then, though?
That is the
22A. 22A, okay.
That would be the 22A amendment.
So that's where somebody messes up and the correct plan will get the money plus the interest, okay.
Correct plan would get interest at the rate essentially of 8.5%, which is the usual rate we use here. The second thing that I point out to you is that the length of the past service period that is subject to correction under this draft is a variable period. It's we will correct any error of past coverage if the error first occurred sometime during the current fiscal year or the prior two fiscal years. So if you assume a July 1 fiscal year, or July 1 is the first day of the fiscal year, and if the error is discovered on that date, the error would be corrected if the error occurred no more than 2 years or 2 years plus 1 day earlier. However, if the error occurred on the very last day of the fiscal year, many, many months later, on June 30th, the error could be corrected if it first occurred almost 3 years earlier. So this is going to result in situations where two very similar individuals are going to be treated differently. One, the past coverage is going to be corrected, and the other, it's not going to be corrected simply due to the date during the current fiscal year in which the error was found. So I have an amendment that would replace that variable period with a specific period. And the period that I suggest in the amendment is 2 years. If you wanted to change that from to some other period, you could certainly do that by a verbal amendment.
A verbal, okay.
Now, what the pension plan administrators have argued is that this language that, as it appears in this amendment, this variable period, is language that the IRS either recommended to them or insisted has to be used in situations where there is erroneous coverage. You may want to have some testimony on that. If you're convinced that if that's a valid argument, then I guess we would have to stick with the use of this variable period, but in any case, the underlying policy is kind of questionable.
Well, okay, let's hear from the funds. And I'm particularly interested, is this going to cut down on the bills that we periodically get just trying to correct errors where people just put the wrong fund and we have to, you know, come back and fix it? I don't know. Mr. Bergstrom, Ms. Vanek, what do you think about this stuff? So?
Mr. Chair, you directed us to go back and come up with a universal approach, and we did that. We thought simplicity was the answer. Hopefully it will reduce the number of special cases that you have. It certainly avoids one that we would have had come to you. Specifically to the interest, we had 12 of these cases, and my staff calculated the total interest on all 12 total would be $112. And it just didn't seem worth it staff time and staff-wise to worry about interest, especially when some of the money's coming in, some of the money's going out. In the end of the day, it's probably not going to make a lot of difference. So we hope it will reduce the number. It is simple. And I will let Ms. Vanek talk about the requirements of the correction period.
Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair, members, Mary Vanek, para-director. We chose the current fiscal year at the point the error is discovered and the two previous fiscal years, not because it's necessarily a requirement of the IRS. It's the guidance we were provided in their correction procedures. It is also the correction period that you supported last year for erroneous contributions reported, the issue we faced with the City of Duluth and other employers. That correction period is from the point within the current fiscal year that you discover it, including the two previous fiscal years, so it's consistent. So while we don't support the amendment that Mr. Burek has suggested, there is a slight amendment that's being requested on page 5, line 13. Before fiscal, if we could insert current to make it clear that it is the current fiscal year in which we discover the error in the two previous fiscal years.
Page 5, line 13.
Page 5, Amendment 18A,
right.
Page 5, line 13.
13. You said you want the current fiscal year. Okay.
Current inserted before fiscal, Mr. Chair.
I will move that.
Why don't we just incorporate it? We'll just incorporate it in 18A amendment. So, okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Either one of the testifiers, but what about to the point about having no penalty in there might encourage bad behavior by somebody from not putting them in the wrong one and holding on to them, and I mean, to that comment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I think in a lot of these cases, the employer made a good faith effort to contribute to the plan. They just got it to the wrong pocket. And so that most of the money was there, really there's probably going to be hardly any penalty back to the employer because they did make the contribution rates. And this is dealing more with if it came to us and it should have gone there. And so kind of our view of that was there was a good faith effort. They made a mistake. The difference is usually not all that great.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Vanek.
I also, to that point, Representative Nelson, a lot of the errors we find are actually between TRA and PARA, and we find them rather quickly. So we've had the ability to transfer the corrections, to make the corrections when there's wrong plan transfers. We'd never had the ability to charge interest. So adding it now, really, when we're limiting the period, really isn't of value, we don't think. It will cost us more to administratively to deal with it than to impose it at this point.
Okay. Anybody else who wants to be heard on this issue of correction of errors? Any amendments we need to discuss? We've already kind of looked at them. Mr. Burke, did you described the one on the interest, but the other ones in here do what? 19, 20, and...
Members, the 19A amendment addresses a different issue. Several of these plans have provisions in them current law, which in part specifies how to handle situations where the individual was placed in a, I'm sorry, the 19A amendment. Several of these plans have provisions in their law which deals with which deals with cases, situations where the person was placed in a defined benefit plan and the person should have been placed in a defined contribution plan. Now, right now, the language that is in the existing law is quite limited. For instance, MSRS may have some language that says if the individual is in the general plan and they should have been in the unclassified plan, the unclassified being a defined contribution plan, we will transfer money to the necessary assets to the unclassified plan. And similarly, in TRA, you might have language saying if the person should have been in higher ed IRAP, we will correct the error by transferring to the higher ed IRAP plan. Since current law indicates that the legislature feels it's acceptable policy to make that kind of a transfer, what I'm simply suggesting in 19A is that it might be reasonable to expand the scope of plans, of defined contribution plans, to which you could make a correction. For instance, what the primary defined contribution plans we have out there are the unclassified plan, the para defined contribution plan, the higher ed IRAP plan, and the IRAP plan covering historical society employees. So with the 19A amendment simply does is says that if there was an error where the person was put in a defined benefit plan and it should have gone to a defined contribution plan, the 19A amendment simply says we'll allow it to go to any of those four plans, whichever happens to be the correct one.
Okay, Mr. Bergstrom, Ms. Manick, any thoughts on that? Or
Mr. Chair, we're okay with that.
You're okay with the 19A amendment? Okay. Is there a motion to adopt the 19A amendment? Representative Kahn moves the 19A amendment? Okay. On the motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion fails. The 19A amendment is adopted. Number 20A.
The 20A amendment addresses the question of interest when the problem is that the person was placed in a defined benefit plan and the person should have been placed in a defined contribution plan. And this would allow that transfer when the correction is made to include interest. The argument for this, particularly if a transfer is not made in a timely manner, is that if the person should have been in a defined contribution plan, we're going to put the assets in that plan. We need to keep in mind that the value of the annuity that will eventually be purchased with that is dependent solely on the account value. And if we don't permit interest to be included with that transfer, that person is harmed by the fact that the account should have been established earlier. It should have been having investment gains applied to it earlier. So this amendment would allow those transfers to be made with 8.5% annual interest.
Any thoughts, Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, members, this is a reasonable amendment.
Okay. Discussion? Is there a motion?
So moved.
Representative Nelson moves the 20A amendment. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. 21A.
Mr. Chairman, this is the issue dealing with the variable timing and replacing it with a fixed period of time, 2 years. But there has been discussion on this. I'm not sure what the commission decided on.
Okay.
This.
Any thoughts on this, Mr. Bergstrom, Ms. Vanek, anybody else?
Mr. Chair, this is the one we didn't want, and we put the word current in instead.
Right. Okay. So the word current, which we incorporated. Okay. Okay. Gotcha. Okay.
So then 22A was on the interest, which was $112 and so forth. Is that
right?
Okay.
Didn't seem to be much interest in that.
Okay. Number 23A.
And the 23A is an amendment that PARA requested be drafted, but my understanding is they don't feel it's necessary at this point.
She's shaking her head. Okay. Okay. So then we have the 18A amendment before us, which is a rewrite of, I guess, a number of provisions. Anybody else want to be heard on the 18A amendment? Is there a discussion? Is there a motion to adopt the 18A amendment as amended?
I will move that and include it in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Representative Murphy moves the 18A amendment as amended. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. And then just to make sure we've cleaned everything up, then Representative Murphy moves the LCPR 10-005 document as amended as part of the omnibus bill. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you.
Okay. Now, number three, Senate File 2474, House File 2738, PERA Service Credit Purchase Procedures. Let's see, Mr. Burke, I guess you've got this one.
Members, this is item three on the agenda, and the bill itself is the final two pages that are attached to your packet here. If you look at the bill, it's essentially, two or three sections. What the first section does is it revises PARA's procedure for purchasing service credit for various leaves of absences. This procedure would be used for paternity leaves, family leaves, unpaid medical leaves, and possibly a few others. And the change that is being recommended here in the bill is found on line 21. Essentially, when contributions are determined, the contributions will be determined using salary as defined in PARA law, except it will exclude overtime pay. And section 2 of the bill does a number of things. The first thing that it does is PARA had a provision in its law permitting individuals to purchase salary credit if they're receiving temporary workers' compensation payments related to service with a public employer. And that provision was found in their definition section. Contributions were based on salary, including overtime, if that was relevant. What Sections 2 and 3 are doing, first of all, is we're repealing the initial language, the initial temporary workers' compensation language, because it's a procedure which shouldn't have been in a definition section. So that's the repealer of Section 3. And it's being picked up again in Section 2. As one of three types of leave that is covered by this new proposed section. The other two being a partial paid medical leave and a partial paid leave of absence as a result of budgetary or salary savings. Now, And all these leaves, the individual would make contributions, again, based on salary but excluding overtime. What seems to be driving the change here is actually a disability situation. And I really question whether the bill as drafted really addresses the underlying problem here. The problem that PARA was faced with was and that they felt needed some sort of action, was that they had an individual who...
Well, maybe PARA can explain their situation better. Ms. Vanek, why don't you explain why the bill's here?
Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate your concern, Mr. Berrick. That is not that's what's driving the one little clause of excluding overtime. But what's driving the bill is the fact that several years ago, some police and fire members came forward and said, during periods of temporary workers' compensation, their salary is reduced. And that happens throughout their employment. And they there was no provision in our statute to allow them to purchase the full salary credit. So if they were receiving two-thirds of their pay through workers' comp and didn't have sick leave to make up the other third, they used sick leave to make up, pay up the other third, they had a lower salary reported. If they would have had no salary reported at all, our law allowed them to purchase that credit. But if they had partial salary reported, they could not purchase to get their salary back to its full value. This was the section of the statute that when we were looking at the furlough issue, we decided they blended together. And so what we're doing here is three different things. Only those who have reduced salary because of temporary workers' comp can make their salary whole. We've had a number of calls from members who have long-term disability or short-term disability coverage, who have a reduced salary by taking partial sick leave payments, but they can't keep their salary whole for a different medical reason other than a workers' comp-related reason, and they were wondering why that wasn't allowed. So we're asking to allow them, folks who take a partially paid medical leave of absence, to be able to make employee and employer contributions plus interest to keep their salary whole. And that's limited to 1 year. Just as if they had unpaid service, that is limited to 1 year to make the purchase. We have also added language that allows those local government employees who have already and are continuing to face reduced salary during furlough periods. Our law has a provision that says if the employer offers or mandates what is called periodic repetitive leave, taking time off, lower salary during a period of time, and the employer agrees to make the employer contribution to keep their salary whole, the employee can make their contributions and keep it whole. But it does not allow an individual whose employer is offering or mandating these reduced salary periods and whose employer is not offering to make that payment to have the same opportunity to make the purchase. So we're asking three things. The driving force was furlough. We discovered the other issue as we were working on this. So the driving force in this bill is to allow individuals who are currently on required to take furloughed periods to help save salary within local government to be able to keep their salary whole by making the contributions to PERA that otherwise would have been paid on that full salary. We're asking that folks on partially paid medical leaves, when it's not workers' comp related, be allowed to do the same thing. And we're also asking that we exclude overtime in the calculation of the salary that we use for them to make that payment. And the driving force behind that was a case that we came across this summer. An individual was earning a lot of overtime, went out on workers' comp, went back to work at 40 hours a week, making regular salary, but because the workers' comp allowed for the payment between the previously earned salary, including overtime, and the regular salary, our law allowed that he could purchase up to the previously earned overtime salary also. We didn't think that's what was intended here. We believe that the intent was to make sure that people could maintain their base. The reason we allow contributions on overtime currently is because that is actually compensation for a service that's been rendered. And that's why it's included in our salary definition. But for purposes of maintaining their base salary in these circumstances, we don't think that overtime that may have been earned immediately prior to this lower salary period should be included, and that's why we're asking to exclude it in the calculation. Mr. Barrick did catch two sections of our law that we also allow purchases that we did not catch the excluding overtime. So two of his amendments we agree with. But the rest of it was simply to deal with furloughs, partially paid medical leaves, and making sure that we don't include an inflated salary in the calculation for this purchase period.
And Ms. Vanek, which of the two amendments that you are okay with?
Amendment A2 and A3.
I see. Well, we'll go through the amendments momentarily, but I just wanted to figure out. Okay, any questions, Ms. Vanek? Representative Murphy.
Clarification, Ms. Vanek, on the furlough. If the employer does not pay in for the furloughed employee, then the employee can pay the employer part and the employee part to make it whole.
Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's what this is doing, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Anybody else wants to be heard on this? Mr. Burke, you had some amendments. Did you want to identify what's where? She already said A2 and A3.
Those are described on page 5 of the memo. Okay. The first amendment, the A1 amendment, is purely technical. Makes the title of a provision a little more clear. The substantive amendments begin with the A2 amendment. And what the A2 amendment would do is it would add PERA's periodic repetitive leave provision to the bill, and it would exclude use of overtime pay in determining contributions to that.
Okay.
An argument for that is it at least gets closer to treating all of PERA's leave provisions the same way.
Okay. Well, the 1A amendment was, as I say, technical. Ms. Vanek, do you have any thoughts on it? It's a head note. Okay. Anybody wants to offer the 1A amendment?
So moved.
Okay. Representative Nelson moves the 1A amendment. Discussion that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Now, the 2A amendment, Ms. Vanek indicated they're okay with that.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of 2A.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Burke.
Perhaps you'd want to look at the A3 amendment, because the A3 amendment is an alternative to the A2.
Okay.
And you wouldn't want to do both.
Okay. Ms. Vanek, you said you're okay with both, but is there a preference?
I apologize. The A3 does incorporate A2, so A3 is...
Okay, is there discussion on A3? Anybody else want to be heard on A3? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. The 3A amendment is adopted. 4A, what does this do?
The A4 amendment essentially drops Section 1 out of the bill so that this revised policy of not using overtime pay for purposes of determining contributions for a leave would be restricted to the three forms of leave that are in Section 2 of the bill. Actually, I think this amendment would not be consistent with the A3 amendment.
Okay. Okay. 5A? Since it's not consistent, what does 5A do?
Well, 5A would not be consistent either.
Okay. 6A?
And the 6A would not be consistent.
7A?
The 7A amendments through 12A, frankly, are drafted more for long-term consideration than for current consideration. It seems as though the real underlying problem here is a problem with PERA's disability provisions and the access to those provisions by individuals who have already retired from a different plan. But it's probably beyond the scope of what you want to address here.
Probably needs to be another issue for another day. Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair and members, I did share with Mr. Barrick an underlying frustration about the fact that individuals who have already earned a pension in another plan come into our police and fire plan and have a short period of service and qualify for these benefits. I think it's a huge policy issue that needs to be discussed. I think it needs a lot of careful consideration to avoid any kind of discrimination on who gets what. And while I appreciate him raising it to you, it's really unrelated to the focus of this bill, and I assure you we will continue our discussions and bring anything back if we feel it's necessary.
See you next year.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else want to bring up any issues on NFL 2474, House File 2739? Okay. Is there a motion to adopt that into the omnibus bill as amended?
So moved.
Representative Pappas moves Senate File 2474, House File 2739 as amended be adopted into the omnibus pension bill. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any other matters to come before us today? Next, we're going to meet next Friday, at least that's the plan. Tuesday night we have a meeting. And that's going to be for the individual constituent bills, small groups, and so forth. A packet's coming out on that one. That's just, again, you know.
We got it.
Okay. You've got the, there's eight issues on there, and those, you know, we'll just bring in the legislators and their affected constituents and see what they want to do. The next Friday, we'll have Milliman, the commission actuary, come in with their presentation, how the numbers are looking. It looks like we'll be doing MRF next Friday. I don't know what the proposal is yet, but apparently there is one, and they'll make that presentation to us. And then in 2 weeks, I think we'll be taking up the big bills on TRA, MSRS, PERA, the long-term stability things, the employer-employee contribution, the cost of living, and so forth. So, I mean, you know about those things. I've been getting a lot of emails. Question for Representative Nelson and Senator Olson. Do you want us to put the TRA retiree board thing back on the agenda or not? I don't know. Do you want me to do it? We will, but at some point we're running out of time here. So what do you want to do?
Can we talk for just, sure. Mr. Chair, just a second?
Well, why don't you can talk offline. Let me know, because okay. I got to tell these folks either it's going to be heard or it's not going to be heard, and I just don't know what you want to do. So let me know, and then if we're going to have a hearing, it's staying on the agenda and it's going to get voted on. So, okay. Anything else? Well, see you on Tuesday night. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.